I thought I'd take a little break from my normal talk about how to alleviate suffering, obsessive thinking, and all that stuff I talk about. And I thought I'd have a little bit of a fun talk for me, because so many people ask me this. They say, why Dharma punks? What's with putting punks behind the Dharma? Why would you do such a thing? And I suppose if you had to get the real historical answer, you'd have to ask Noah or read his book, which I've done both, and I know his reasons, and they're very solid. But I also, since I joined this Sangha and became teacher, I have also my own sort of way I interpret it, which is sort of, I think, it helps keep me grounded in what I want to accomplish as a teacher here, and I thought I would share about it. There'll be some, I hope, interesting bits about it. Of course, it goes without saying, and I know that Noah has spoken about it, that there's a lot of similarities between the core values of the punk generation, of which I was certainly a member during the 70s, a rejection of consumerism and materialism, a refocus on questioning the goals and the belief systems of the dominant culture. There was a lot of questioning of authority. And all of those attributes are very much in the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha was certainly anti-materialist to the extreme. I mean, he did believe in using the requisites of having clothes, shelter, food, and medicine. But beyond that, he said that the spiritual path, a path to happiness, came from within. It was not about consuming the world for your happiness. So there is a lot of similarities in the somewhat rejectionism of the dominant culture that the Buddha exemplified. But there's more reasons to me that that are very dear to my heart. When I grew up, I was a teenager in the middle 70s, and the music that was rock had become incredibly diluted and made terrible by people that were trying to make it pleasant and appeasing for mass market. What they did was they took the raw energy of Eddie Cochran's Summertime Blues, the Rolling Stones' Let's Spend the Night Together, or Mother's Little Helper, the power of the Kinks, You Really Got Me. And it became diluted to the point where groups like Fleetwood Mac and Journey and the Holocaust that is Chicago all could try to camp beneath the umbrella that was originally rocks. There even became things called soft rock, which, you know, I can't even think of a less meaningful phrase or true possible. There's nothing that could be soft rock. The moment it becomes soft, it is not rock, right? So, anyway, so around 1976, I actually was in London. My parents relocated there for a while, and I was there when the punk movement began. And I was fascinated not only by the dress, but by the sheer return to the raw energy behind rock. Music was once again stripped of all the guitar solos, the frilly little bits, the soft melodic singing, the singing about, about stuff that, you know, the, I mean, Led Zeppelin was singing about, you know, Tolkien-esque children dancing in the park or whatever. And suddenly people were once again singing about, like, the Ramones suddenly came out with 53rd and 3rd, which was about being a rent boy. And there was a song, Chinese Rocks, about shooting up dope. And there was, you know, suddenly I saw the Bad Brains, and they were just back to this core energy between ska and punk. And there was this, and there was this return, a rejection of all the frilly, appeasing, diluting stuff that watered down music and made it, and then people were trying to just make it sellable. But by making it sellable, they made it shit. Right? So what the fuck? And this not only happened in rock, by the way. It happened in, God forbid, soul. The great soul of Bobby Womack and Curtis Mayfield and Marvin Gaye. Suddenly, these guys were singing Look Across 110th Street and, you know, Inner City Blues. And then what's next? Remember Dobie Gillis, where everybody sings, Dobie Gray, everybody sings the blues sometimes. Killed it. He killed fucking soul music. You know? Yeah, one moment he got, look across 110th Street, people shooting dope on the street. You're like, oh shit, he sang that? Next thing, he's like, everybody sings blues. You're like, it's dead. It died. They eviscerated it. They castrated it. So, guess what? The exact same thing happened to Buddhism. I've been studying it for going on 3 decades. And going to Buddhist centers for 20 years. And I used to wonder, like, wow, the things I read in the original teachings of the Pali Canon, what the Buddha taught, it's so fucking great. It's so fucking balls out. It's so bang, bang, bang. This is why you're suffering. This is what you go. He pulls no punches. And he said, you know what? The mind creates suffering because that's what it does. And if we're going to find peace, we've got to train ourselves to develop the thoughts and the activities that will bring ourselves lasting peace. It was a radical sense of teachings. And the problem is, in the 70s, when Buddhism started to become popular, suddenly there were all these people in Vipassana and in Zen and in Tibetan, and they were sort of hippies. Some of them were leftists, some of them were therapists, some of them were artists, and all these people came flooding in. They were like, okay, this is good, we like a little bit of what we're hearing, but, you know, suppose we make it a little nicer here. Suppose we, you know, a lot of this stuff is a little bit demanding. It's not going to fly that well, you know. We got a bunch of ideas. We're just going to soften the edges. And I'm going to tell you where they did, and where I'm kicking that shit back out. The first way, a lot of leftists, and I'm a leftist, and environmentally focused people, which I consider myself, and people who are interested in global politics, came in, and they're like, okay, this stuff about ending suffering, it's all good, it's all good. Don't get me wrong, we like that. But we're really interested in global warming, and we really want the teaching to be all about interconnectedness. Because that's really a nice word, interconnectedness, interdependence, everything's all interconnected. Let's make it all about that. And you hear a lot of people talking about it. There's even groups here at the center that talk a lot about it. And the Buddha certainly said that in many ways the actions we do reverberate out and certainly have ramifications, he said, that are completely beyond our ability to even comprehend. The stuff we've done to this planet is so toxic and so beyond our capabilities of even seeing how bad it is. But we do know, yeah, we are responsible for a lot of terrible things, including global warming and the pollution of the Pacific and just the toxification of the groundwater. And, you know, you could go on and on and on. But the Buddha's teachings really didn't focus on interconnectedness. The Buddha was actually teaching that we're too trying to get our happiness from the world, and that we've got to rebalance by trying to develop a peace within. The Buddha said, when he looked at mankind, he said he saw a bunch of fish flopping about in a puddle that was dwindling. And the reason it was dwindling is because all those fish were trying to get their happiness, were trying to just consume everything around them. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to get our happiness by consuming more and more and more. And what the Buddha wanted was us to refocus back to where there is an endless supply of peace. And that's from inner practice, that's from reflecting on our skillfulness, that's from wise action, that's from being skillful in our speech, that's from making sure we're diligent about the kinds of thoughts that we cultivate in the mind. That comes from a lot of practice. So in the end, the Buddha's teachings do have a lot of benefit to the environment, because he's teaching us to consume less. He never says to starve ourselves. He says to make do with the food and shelter and medicine and clothing that we skillfully accomplish. But he says do not consume those things to the extent that it causes our spiritual practice, our usefulness to ourselves and others, to diminish. So it's about a balance. But again, the core of the Buddhist teachings is not about interconnectedness or interdependence. It's about turning inwards to see how we're causing stress and suffering in our own mind. And by doing that, once we see that the way we cause harm to other people and consume the world makes us more stressed out, makes us more uncomfortable, we will stop doing it. It's a byproduct. It's not the focus of his teachings. I wish I could come here and tell you that the Buddha was a radical vegan environmentalist who wore dreads and drove a single fixed gear bike and that he lived in Williamsburg and that he had big dork corks and that he only ate tofu. But the truth is, the Buddha taught kings and poor people, middle class people, he taught everyone. He was basically a radical psychologist who came up with a way of ending suffering, and he wanted everybody to know it. And he said, as a result, if people put this into practice, there will be less suffering in the world. That's the way it works. Now, the second thing that came into Buddhism was a bunch of artists, painters, musicians came in, and they said, well, we really like the idea that the Buddha doesn't like the ego, doesn't like this small little self-centered I. So what we think is maybe it would be really good if the Buddha taught that everything was about being spontaneity and about following your gut and about intuition is really good. Yeah, that would sound really good. So let's start talking about that. Let's start making that Buddhism. The problem is that the Buddha did not believe that following our gut all the time or trusting our intuition is always the right thing to do. He actually taught that, like Malcolm Gladwell in his book Blink shows, that a lot of our gut feelings are quite wrong. A lot of the times our gut feelings will lead us to the exact worst place we should go. Sometimes our gut really wants to tell people to go fuck off. Sometimes my gut wants me to shoot dope.
Sometimes my gut wants me to do really stupid things. Now, sometimes my gut wants me, you know, sometimes my gut has been right. Sometimes I've wound up in relationships in my life where my gut was going, maybe we should take it slow. I was like, never mind. Never mind. So there's times your gut is right. There's times the gut is wrong. What the Buddha said is to test everything, to see what brings happiness and to see what brings stress. Moreover, he said, make sure to his son Rahula and his teachings with his son, he said, before you do anything, don't act spontaneously. Ask yourself, this thing I'm about to do, is it going to cause harm to myself or to someone else? What's the goal here? Do I really want to achieve something not harmful, or is there a tendency in here to want to get back or cause problems or separate people or just take care of myself at all expense to other people? So that's not spontaneity. Far from it. That's a very, very careful but open approach to life where we get to see what really works. We get to learn for ourselves what causes happiness and what causes suffering. But it's not about just following your gut or acting free, donning a caftan and racing about. It's about really seeing from our own experience and asking ourselves, what am I trying to accomplish here? Now, there's another subset of this where people came in and they said, we really want the Buddha to be about non-duality. That sounds good. That sounds very accepting of everything. The Buddha, we think, really didn't believe have any black and white to him. He was always, you know, seeing everything as, you know, just this big whole, and breaking it down into good or bad, that's not very Buddha-like at all. Actually, the problem is the Buddha did exactly that. When you study the Buddha looked at actions all the time in terms of whether they caused suffering or whether they caused peace. He broke down all of our thinking and all of our actions in terms of the words kusala and akusala, whether they're skillful, i.e. they don't cause harm, or whether they are unskillful and they cause harm in the future. So, in fact, the Buddha, when he related the story of his enlightenment, he did it by, he said, watching all of his thoughts and seeing which thoughts cause stress, and he put those eventually in the unworthy pile. And then he saw which thoughts in the long term create peace and tranquility. And the more he focused and cultivated these thoughts, the more peaceful he became until he could let go more of the thoughts and find more space within. And from that place, he relaxed and let go of progressively all these things he was carrying until he found true lasting inner peace. Another thing, I'm just going to go through a few more. One thing that's really popular, psychiatrists and therapists came into Buddhist centers, not to be undone by the artists and the other people I've discussed. The psychiatrist said, you know what would be really nice? It would be really nice if there was this thing called Buddha nature. That deep within us, once we get rid of the greed and the anger and the selfishness, there would be this loving core of goodness that would beam outwards like a flower that has exposed itself. A beautiful flower, a beaming energy of light that has now come and shown to everyone once we've gotten rid of the crap that's covered it up. The problem with this is that there's no place anywhere where the Buddha says there's such a thing called Buddha nature. In fact, the Buddha throughout says there is nothing that we can point to as a core identity, good or bad. He said if anything, the mind naturally causes stress because the mind is programmed to survive the way the world was tens of thousands of years ago, where death was everywhere, and where the sole purpose of the mind was to keep us alive just for another day. So the mind is not a peace, tranquility machine. The mind by nature is a holy shit, what is that person thinking about me machine. It's not about, ooh, this would make me happy. It's about, ooh, holy fuck, that person looks like they want to eat me. So the mind doesn't have a gooey pink inner cloud. But the good news is the Buddha taught that we can actually cultivate it. And through what neuroscientists now call neuroplasticity, it's been demonstrated that even though the mind generally likes to jump around, and that jumping around from thought to observation to worry to thought, just that jumping around causes stress. It releases dopamine, it releases cortisol. It actually causes a lot of stress. Just the mind jumping about requires so much endeavor. He found that through practice, we can actually rewrite the mind to relax and override the amygdala, which causes the worrying, jumping around, inability to focus. Even people who have difficulty with focusing or attention can actually, they found, rewire the mind through meditation. So we, even though the mind is not doesn't have this inner Buddha that's waiting to come out, the good news is we can put it there through practice. Okay? So it's not about unleashing something, it's about developing something. It's not about, I look at it this way, there's this idea of the Mozart myth, that we think, oh, great musicians are people who had it innately, and it was just a matter of them just sitting in front of a piano and they could write a concerto. But for the rest of us, it's actually practicing for hours at the piano, and eventually we can play it. And that's really what the Buddha taught. It's not that there's this inner thing, it's that we develop it. So finally, the last myth that we are exploding with our Dharma punksism is there's this idea that was brought in by the philosophy bents of us, those that are the nihilists amongst us. The Buddha taught that all phenomena, and this is true, he did teach this, is impermanent. Everything that is fabricated by the mind, everything that we experience, eventually ends. It comes to a close. Everything is impermanent. So the idea is that some people wanted to believe, well, the core teaching then is enjoy life while it passes, knowing it's all going to go away. And there's the benefit of knowing that when life is shitty, this too will pass. Now, all of this is true. Shitty times do pass, and yes, life is impermanent, and yes, it's important to get in touch with death, but it's not the entire story. The Buddha taught that there is a real lasting peace that's available, and he called it that which doesn't die, that which doesn't end. That's what nibbana means. It means a state that we can attain that in fact can go on. Now, I'm not saying it goes on beyond death, although there's some traditional Buddhists who believe it, but what I do believe is that unlike the sources of happiness we do attach to in the world for happiness, for instance, our careers, our physical beauty, our relationships or our families, our wealth, our possessions, all of those things can be taken away. All of us can wake up tomorrow and there could be some catastrophic financial downturn. Whatever savings we have could be wiped away. Happens all the time. Careers suddenly get taken away. Physical health can go away in the snap of a finger. Relationships all of a sudden end for various reasons. All of these material things that we attach to
for purpose, for happiness, for a sense of value. They all can go. But what can't go is your mind. If it does, you're pretty much gone. So you do always have the ability to focus within, to reflect on skillful things you've done, to reflect on how you've been virtuous. You could have done something that was selfish, but you didn't do it. The Buddha once said, if nobody could pay me millions of dollars to kill someone, then I have something worth millions of dollars. I have something that can't be bribed. I have something beyond riches. The Dalai Lama once said that if I can appreciate the happiness of others, my happiness goes up by 6 billion because there are 6 billion people on the planet. If my happiness is just contingent on me getting mine, then my chance of happiness goes down to one 6 billionth of what it could be. So if we look to things that are always there, always available, always within our reach, the breath, the body sensations, cultivating wise thoughts, reflecting on skillful actions, generosity, goodwill for ourselves, acceptance and appreciation of the skillfulness of others, cultivating peace by focusing the mind. All of these things are always available. Nobody can take them from you. They don't have any side effects, and nobody can charge you a dime for it. It's always there. So in that sense, it is deathless. It is permanent. It is always there. So there is something that we can strive for that can't be taken away from us. So that's my punk rock agenda for this place. You've heard it. It's out there in the open. To bring back some of the beauty that was the original teachings, and to offer to you the teachings of the monks that I've studied with and the original core teachings. So welcome. Thank you so much for listening. And I hope if you have any questions or thoughts or concerns, now is the time to ask any of them. Thanks for listening. Hey.